because what he says is, woe to them who follow in the rebellion of Korah. So we're going to look at Korah's story today in Numbers chapter 16, and I hope that will help us illustrate what Jude is trying to teach us. While you're turning there, I do want to say thank you for the many books that many of you have brought for the jail ministry. There are now so many books, but please keep bringing them. But there are now so many books that we filled the bookshelf up at the jail, and now the cell walls are lined with them. And the boys just love it. They receive them with tears. They're very grateful, so thank you for that. Something else I want to announce that I wish I would have announced in the first service too, but nonetheless, if you're here, you'll get to witness it. And that is, starting next Sunday, our preacher boys are going to be giving our communion devotions. So we're very excited about that. Each preacher boy will have a Sunday. Except for the last one, there'll be two preacher boys, and we're looking forward to that. I think it's going to be a time of great blessing and encouragement. Well, here in Numbers chapter 16, we are looking at a character named Korah. And like Cain and Balaam, mentioned in the same verse in Jude chapter 1, verse 11, he is an example of who not to follow. Korah is also an Old Testament character like Cain and Balaam. Jude's point in using Old Testament characters is to demonstrate a single fact that has been true since the beginning of time, that we must obey God and the authorities he has established. In those eras, it was the worship the patriarchs had been given, like Adam and Eve and Noah, or later on, the law of Moses, like in the era of Balaam and now Korah. But whatever era, dispensation, time, place, culture, or people, there is one fact that remains above all. We must obey God and his authorities. Korah's story is largely told in Numbers chapter 16. We are really going to dissect this chapter today, because we must understand the multiple lessons taught in this passage if we are going to avoid the error of Korah in the church today. Notice again that Jude pulls an Old Testament example to make a New Testament point, and that is the point that we must obey God and his authorities. And in Korah's specific example, we must learn to obey the authorities God has put into place in our time, just as there were authorities put into place at the time of Korah that he had to obey, but he chose not to his destruction. Let's begin reading Numbers chapter 16. We're going to look at verses 1 through 3 to start out. Korah, son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, and certain Reubenites, Dathan and Abiram, sons of Eliab, and On son of Peleth, became insolent and rose up against Moses. With them were 250 Israelite men, well-known community leaders, who had been appointed members of the council. They came as a group to oppose Moses and Aaron, and said to them, "You have gone too far. The whole community is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is with them. Why then do you set yourselves above the Lord's assembly?" There are a few facts from this passage immediately worth repeating. Number one, three men of Israel, one from the tribe of Levi, the priestly tribe, and two from the tribe of Reuben, the first tribe, challenged Moses' right to exercise authority over the Israelites. Point number two, 250 other men joined them. They were well-known community leaders. This was basically a large mass of the local politicians. But verse 3, this is our third point, is the crux of the whole story. Korah and his group took a true fact that all of Israel was in fact holy and set apart by God, but then they used that true fact to draw a false conclusion that they thought they were just as qualified and had the same function and authority as Moses and Aaron. If this kind of thinking sounds familiar, there are multiple modern examples of similar faulty thinking today. There are modern social movements all around us that take true scriptural, factual verses, like Galatians 3:28, for example, but then they draw false conclusions from them, and they say that everyone is equal in everything, even with regards to authority or some functions in the church. As you can see, this is equally incorrect thinking along the lines of Korah's rebellion. Many churches today practice a form of church government called congregational rule, where every month so-called business meetings are held that determine every course of the church by popular vote. This modern concept effectively makes any kind of authority in the church by name only. Needless to say, mob rule and popularity contest a united church does not make. This is equally incorrect thinking in line with Korah's rebellion. Finally, modern family structures have often reduced or even eliminated the need for one spouse or the other, or replaced it with an ungodly replacement, effectively eliminating God's blessing as to the authority, function, and purpose of the family structure. This is also equally incorrect thinking in line with Korah's rebellion. But before we move on to the rest of the chapter, let us point out a couple of other facts. One, Moses had not appointed himself. He had not been elected by the people. He did not raise to leadership by any method other than God had put him there. This was also true of Aaron, who was given the authority and the function and the responsibility of the priesthood from God, but only out of grace, not by Moses' hand or his own hand or by popular election. Otherwise, the authority God has put into place is exactly what God had wanted and all that was required. If you study Moses and Aaron in the Bible, it was not leadership they originally sought. It was not a position they envied. Also consider this. Moses could not perform Aaron's job, and Aaron could not perform Moses' job. They could not assume each other's position. Moses was of the tribe of Levi, but he was not Aaron or a son of Aaron, so he could not be a priest who served in the tabernacle. Moses respected this division authority so much that later on in this same chapter, Moses tells Aaron that in order to intercede for the people, Aaron had to be the one that did it. It was not Moses' position or function. We would be wise to respect these divisions of authority and function in the church all the same, as Jude points out in Jude chapter 1, verse 11, for our understanding today. Now let's continue reading in Numbers chapter 16, this time verses 4 through 11. When Moses heard this, he fell face down. Then he said to Korah and all his followers, "In the morning the Lord will show who belongs to him and who is holy, and he will have that person come near to him. The man he chooses he will cause to come near him. You, Korah, and all your followers are to do this. Take censers, and tomorrow put fire and incense in them before the Lord. The man the Lord chooses will be the one who is holy. You Levites have gone too far." Moses also said to Korah, "Now listen, you Levites. Isn't it enough for you that the God of Israel has separated you from the rest of the Israelite community and brought you near to do work at the Lord's tabernacle, to stand before the community and to minister to them? He has brought you and your fellow Levites near to himself, but now you are also trying to get the priesthood. It is against the Lord that you and your followers have banded together. Who is Aaron that you should grumble against him?" Moses' countenance is downcast. He is devastated that Korah, Dathan, and Abiram have made this false argument from true fact and rose up this mutiny of local leaders. Moses knows this will not and cannot end well unless he can talk them out of this, so he pleads with them. First, Moses responds directly to the accusers. He tells them how God will sort this out and everyone was to do in order for God to make his will clear to those who were present. Second, Moses tries to talk them out of this nonsense in advance. Moses knows that if they follow the instructions given, they will fail the test and suffer accordingly. There is no winning for Korah, Dathan, and Abiram here. There is no means or way this rebellion is going to have a positive ending. That's why so many thousands of years later, Jude writes, "Woe to them who follow in the way the rebellion of Korah." One major reason why churches fail or split in modern times is the deterioration of New Testament church government. When people assume authority they have not been given by God, when people believe in something, regardless if it is true or not, but they do not go through God's established authority for approval or critique, they disobey God, and there is no good end to that approach. The end does not justify the means. Even if our cause is just, even if our conclusion is right, and even if the results seem good, if the means we use to accomplish such ends was disobedient to God's established authority, God's hand is not in it, and our success will be temporary at best. So if or when a church uses an arbitrary system to defy the collective, unanimous will of the local church authority, they err, regardless if it was the right choice or not. Why? Because God has specifically said that those authorities will answer to Him for the direction of His people, not us. God has placed in their hands the responsibility, the weight, and the burden of authority and the church's success in all things biblical. If they fail to do their job, that is on them, and God will judge them. It is not our place to take God's judgment into our hands. However, if the church supersedes that authority through non-biblical means, those who defied God's authority will likewise answer, just as Korah did. Because this problem is an issue in so many churches, it is useful to also look at similar examples in the New Testament to confirm the above conclusions. In Acts chapter 6, the apostles gave the people the right to choose those who would distribute food to them. They chose by casting lots. I say this confidently because there are 25 references in the Bible, both Old and New Testament, that show when Jews or Romans decided issues in groups, they did so by casting lots. To assume they did so by any other means is speculative, imaginative, out of context, out of the time period, and out of the cultures present. Then the people presented their choices to the apostles, approving the apostles' approach. The word approving is the Greek word aresko, meaning to please or to confirm with service. Otherwise, the approach the people took was not to assume authority from the apostles. The people listened and obeyed God's authority, approving or confirming it as a recognition of their service completed under the apostles' command. The word confirm means to get behind, to approve, or to submit. It cannot mean the opposite. All of the above resulted in a united church in Jerusalem where what was needing done was done, both physically and spiritually, under the authority of the apostles at that time. The other New Testament example of similar behavior is in Acts chapter 15. By this time, the church at Jerusalem had elders. And notice in chapter 15, verses 2, verse 4, verse 6, and 22, how the apostles were always working with and co-equal with the local elders established in the church by that time. Elders did not exist yet as of Acts chapter 6, because one of the qualifications for an elder is not to be a recent convert. However, by Acts chapter 15, several years later, elders had been appointed and were serving, and from this point on in New Testament history, the apostles never assumed their authority over the local eldership. They always worked with them. Further evidence for this is in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 1, where Peter, an apostle, becomes a local church elder before assuming authority in that local church. If the apostles felt the need to honor the position, the authority, the function, and the responsibility of the eldership, so should we. As well, notice it was the people who deferred to the apostles and elders in Acts chapter 15, verse 2. In verse 6, it is precisely the apostles and the elders who looked into this matter. The congregation is mentioned elsewhere in the passage, but not here. This was not a congregational decision. This was not to be decided by mob rule or a popularity contest. This issue was to be determined by the authorities God had established for these matters. Notice, too, in verse 7, that there was much debate among the apostles and the elders. If you think elders' meetings are unanimous, easy, no questions asked affairs, you are wrong. However, when it came time to address the congregation again in verses 12, 22, and 30, they were united in their message, and the congregation each time got behind them. Can the congregation or a group therein question a decision? Sure. Can a congregation or a group therein disagree with a decision? Absolutely. Job questioned God, and he was not considered sinful for it. However, the congregation does not have the right to usurp the established authority. Sometimes we disagree and obey under protest. So be it. There is nothing inherently wrong with that. The time when it stretches into sin and judgment is when, like Korah, a congregation actually disobeys the authority God has established. At that point, there is no recourse. The first century Greek word for vote, or psephos, exists in many writings outside the Bible at that time, but it does not occur in the Bible even one time. The truth is that mob rule, popularity contest, or any other kind of mass vote of a group of people that has been given authority to actually override the authorities God has made in the church is not only non-biblical, it is anti-biblical and destructive. It tells God he was wrong for not including it in his prescribed plan of authority for the local church. I do not think in any way that is a good idea. Each time in the New Testament, the congregation confirmed, approved, or served with the decisions made by the local church eldership. The elders of the various writers, or the letters of the various writers of the New Testament show such decisions were sometimes not received joyfully, and sometimes they were not obeyed. Obeying under protest was tolerated and discussed, but disobedience was always universally condemned, no exceptions. Many in our modern culture shun such a social structure. There are many movements to turn everything into a popularity contest or decide everything by mass rule. The more our country heads in this direction, do we really find it coincidental that the masses keep voting in for themselves massive tax breaks, cash subsidies, and other gifts from the common treasury? Do we really find it accidental that current generations have stolen from future generations at no expense to themselves because they can merely vote for themselves access to someone else's money, even those who are not even born yet? If the church is run this way, will it be any accident that people will vote to give themselves more power, less responsibility, and less of a burden in service than what God has prescribed? Hence, all of these are the errors of Korah. And Jude warns emphatically against them in verse 11 of his letter. Well, returning to the story of Korah, we see Moses pleading with Korah, Dathan, and Abiram to abandon their futile and destructive cause. Moses makes three arguments against their position, mainly to Korah. First, Korah was discontent along with the Levites who had joined them. You know 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 6. Godliness with contentment is great gain. Korah did not know that. They did not merely want to serve the priesthood. They wanted to be priests themselves. But that authority and function was reserved for Aaron's sons alone. Dathan and Abiram were not Levites at all. And so their position and function was completely outside the priesthood or its service. Moses again affirms that Aaron was not chosen out of goodness. You remember the golden calf in Exodus chapter 32 that Aaron helped the Israelites build? Instead, God had appointed Aaron out of grace to the priesthood. Aaron's appointment was not from merit, but to demonstrate that even the authorities God had established were still men and men capable of sin. A good question, but one that has a good answer, is a similar dilemma. What if there are times the elders in a local church make suboptimal decisions? What if they have not considered all the facts or heard all the arguments, or they ultimately make a poor, dysfunctional decision? Is there justifiable disobedience then? The answer to that question is the same one Moses gives. No. Elders, just like Moses and Aaron and his sons, are imperfect. They are men. They are prone to error. No human being escapes the traps of sin, logical miscalculations, and sometimes just plain poor judgment. Moses, Aaron, and every other authority ever established by God, even the apostles, would make mistakes, lose people, and sometimes cause problems all on their own. But in no case did they lose their authority or position or function because of a wrong decision. The only exception is disobedience to Scripture itself, which 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 19 and 20, provides the direct procedure of dealing with that. The point is that even if Korah was right, even if Moses and Aaron had been leading poorly, that did not mean their authority had been taken away. In fact, as amazing as it is, God allowed the priesthood to continue as he originally assigned it, even when priests of very poor character and action possessed the office. The sons of Aaron were sinful and immoral men, but they were not judged until Leviticus chapter 10, years later, for their offering of strange fire. The sons of the prophet Samuel, the last prophet and the first judge, were rotten. Eli, Samuel's mentor and predecessor, was known for his gluttony and his poor parenting. His sons ran amok. Yet the requirement that the descendants of the sons of Aaron had to be the priest who served in the tabernacle was never changed by God until the law of Moses was abrogated by Christ nearly 1,500 years later. Sometimes God did remove poor leaders from Israel's history. God did the same in the New Testament. Think of Judas's removal or Demas in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 10. Sometimes leaders were called out, but they repented, like Peter in Galatians chapter 2. However, this did not remove Peter's position as an apostle or disqualify him for the eldership later on in 2 Peter chapter 5. Paul actually gives specific instructions to bringing a charge against an elder in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verses 19 and 20. That is how the qualifications or actions of an elder may be handled, no other. All the same, Korah had no right or even a proper charge to bring against Moses or Aaron. Korah took a scriptural truth and ripped it out of context to make a false argument and a rebellious mutiny. Although Korah was a Levite, and up to that point, he was a faithful Israelite, his equality in the sharing of the atonement did not give him equality in authority, position, or function. We would be wise to note and follow these distinctions repeatedly brought up in the Bible, Old or New Testaments. In verses 12 through 14, Dathan and Abiram, Korah's friends from the tribe of Reuben, try to make similar but faulty arguments. Moses does not even answer them. Moses had delivered God's terms, presented God's arguments, and the time for talk was done. People will either comply or move on at that point. Endless discussion is not the means or the ends. Obeying God is the only acceptable means and ends. Needless to say, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, because they did not repent, were judged. The 250 who rose up with them in rebellion were as well judged. The rebellion of Korah goes down in biblical history in the book of Numbers, but Jude brings it up again in his book, and his book is the second to the last book of the New Testament, to make the point that the rebellion of Korah is just as relevant today as it was then, and we should heed his example of what not to do. All the same, one of the absolute hardest things to do in the whole world, especially in today's world, is to voluntarily submit to authority, especially if we disagree with that authority. I myself sympathize with that. So does Paul in Romans chapter 13. in the Bible, many disagreed with not only God's established human authorities, but God himself. But it was not their disagreement they were judged for. Many disagreed under protest, but they obeyed. They were spared judgment. And even God says of Job's many questions and protest, "My servant did not sin." Yet the Bible also tells of those who disagreed and would not obey, and unto their perdition, like Korah. Let us not make that mistake. This is also, honestly, the hardest part of becoming a Christian if you are not one already. Putting yourself under God's authority, specifically the authority he has prescribed in his word. The world today, especially our culture as it is now, is vehemently opposed to God's word. They dismiss it, they ban it, they argue with it, and therefore they disobey it. Standing against culture, rebelling against this world, is not an easy stance. Christians everywhere are ridiculed, marginalized. They lose their jobs, sometimes the association of their families. They are persecuted for going against the grain, for being countercultural forces, not bowing to society's ever-changing positions on just about everything. But in that obedience to God, there is victory over this world. Jesus said, "Take heart, for I have overcome the world." This world is passing away. Is that not evident? Wars, rumors of wars, incredible debt, out of control massacres to this very week, natural disasters, a lack of trust, no peace. Tell me, is submitting to this world going to buy you one lasting bit of satisfaction, joy, and fellowship? Or is submitting to God going to get you those very things? We must truly ask which we will submit to. In the words of Joshua, faithful leader of the second generation of Israelites, this is what he says: "Choose for yourselves this day who you will serve. As for me and my household, we will serve the Lord." Today, you will choose who you will serve. We all must serve someone. If you want to serve the Lord, either to be baptized as a new Christian, to rededicate your faith, or to join this local church and our fellowship in service to God, then please come down here and see me as we stand and as we sing.